Grade 7 Conference, Lecture 72, Physiology, Part 11. We will conclude our look at the ear. So, back to the ossicles, the little bones, which Steiner says were completely misnamed and that they really were talking about a hand and a little arm that's reaching out. So certainly, you know, I would say not to improve on Steiner, of course, but we can think of the eardrum and all that leads to it as being the sensory part of this sense organ. That's where it is truly a sense organ. When we get to the ossicles, we're talking about a rhythmical part. Though they are bones, they're really not so deeply connected. They're a great refinement of our system of limb and metabolic. They're rhythmically now taking that sound and moving it over to the inner ear, the cochlea in particular, which Steiner says is like a little piece of our intestine, our metabolic system brought up into our head. But before we get there, something very important is going on here via the ossicles. Sound is being transmitted through air. And you already know from your sixth grade acoustics block, or do it this year if you haven't, that when you work with different media in order to transmit sound, and by media here I mean, you know, listening to sound underwater as opposed to air, even going out on a foggy day if you can, those of you in the Bay Area have no problem here, and have students call to one another in the fog, and then go out later in the day when it's cleared and have them call to one another much better in fog. If there's any moisture in the air, sounds will carry better. Sounds will carry better over a lake than they do over a meadow. And to hear sounds through metal, through wood, you know, banging on banisters, planks, whatever. So we know that air is so-so as a medium for transmitting sound. It's kind of a compromise that we made. It's a lot easier for us to breathe air than water the way we're constituted, but it would really be better if we could communicate underwater, and in a way we do, because the ossicles have the task of transmitting what is called a mismatched impedance, because they're moving sound from air into the realm of water, into the drop of fluid that resides in the cochlea, which was only discovered centuries after everything else in the ear was discovered in that story I told you about the freezing of the cochlea to reveal that ear, that drop of water that was there. So this is very interesting. Moving something from air to water, you need rhythm, don't you? Didn't we see that in the respiratory circulatory system? The interplay of the lungs and the heart's very, very complicated. To move that air, oxygen and carbon dioxide, in and through the blood, you've got to have a real working together. The ossicles, I would say, are more like the heart and the lungs than they are, I would say, modestly, humbly, rather than real arms and legs. So anyway, there is that very, very important kind of movement going on. And just so you know that the terms cochlea and labyrinth, they were coined by our friend Gabriello Fallopio. I don't think I ever did mention to you that his first name was Gabriel and that he's the man who discovered the reproductive system. And he also looked in the rest of the body. And, you know, you feel, well, was this the first guy who ever opened up a body? What about Leonardo? He looked so carefully. But a couple of things are going on. You know, Fallopio clearly has a predisposition for going more deeply into the secretive part of the human being. So that's what he's going to look for. Secondly, his first name is Gabriel. He's being inspired by an archangel who's also going to awaken him to certain interrelationships in the body. So it's not like things are just there and we see them or we don't see them. It's in a way that somebody like Fallopio is almost creating organs in the body because his predisposition is to see how certain things work and be less interested in others. But then it takes a couple of hundred years for that drop of water to be discovered in the cochlea, and then it takes another couple of hundred years, almost a century actually, before Alfonso Corti discovers the tiny hairs within the cochlea, called to this day the organ of Corti. He needed a microscope in order to do that. So, you know, Leonardo shows us the anatomy of the eye, and it's about 95% accurate. It took centuries, 3-4 centuries, for the ear to be completely anatomatized because it doesn't yield its secrets so well. So we can say that the transmission of light into us, a very profound mystery for sure, and we're going to look at that when we study the eye, but the transmission of sound, much deeper mystery. We might say, you know, in the scale of the ancient mysteries, this would be a much higher level of initiation, of understanding the mysteries of the human being. We're going much more deeply in the temple when we come here, and we are seeing how sound, how the word becomes flesh. That's really what the ear is all about. That's what it's teaching us. So, of course, it should not surprise us that although with the work of Xerox PARC and Steven Jobs and Bill Gates, so we have the Apple operating system on the Macintosh computer, very iconographic, and then Microsoft picks that up and brings it into Windows and so on. And we see more and more the computer screen is all about the interplay of light and image. Fantastic. Our eye is just, you know, getting a smorgasbord there of delights. But when it comes to speech, the simulation of speech and the understanding, and I put that in major quotation marks, the digestion of speech, the processing of speech, whatever one wants to call it, this is to this day called the holy grail of the world, the digital world, to be able to do with speech what has been done already with image. For, you know, a robot who says, I can understand complete sentences, or actually, they sound more Californian now, you know. Yeah, like, I can understand complete sentences. Go ahead. No, you can't. You know, you're not understanding what I really want. So that's tricky. How to really take hold of speech. The ear, and we might say the larynx along with it, are not about to yield that secret for some time to come. So let's look for a moment at the outer ear and the inner ear. The auricle, the ear that we see, that is like an open spiral, and it allows the world of sound from the outer world to funnel into it. The cochlea, however, is a closed spiral. So it's one that is drawing ever closer, a logarithmic spiral, a labyrinthine spiral, and it is really giving a kind of limit. It's, you know, you'll see this in eighth grade when you work with the logarithmic spiral and the Fibonacci series. And it also, of course, resembles a little snail that's within us. This little crustacean is the only vestige of an exoskeleton that we carry within us. There's a little creature there who belongs to a much, much earlier stage of evolution. So the outer spiral is an earlier stage of our own development, our embryo that we carry in double form on our head. And the cochlea is a vestige of a very early stage of Earth evolution, when there were creatures that carried their skeletons outside of them. So this goes back to a time when nothing on the Earth possessed anything inward, really. But organic life was that much more sensitive to everything that was streaming from outside, from the cosmos. And this is when the Word was becoming flesh, when cosmic words were being spoken by lofty beings and the world was being formed. So we could say that what was coming from the highest realms, the starry galaxies, which are, of course, spiraling all the time, that was what was forming the spirals of these exoskeletal creatures. And therefore, this form is going to be very, very open to the formative forces coming from outside in the world of sound. So I'm going to give you just one more snapshot of the activity of the ear, and then I'll leave the rest of it going more deeply into the metabolic side, up to your own research. Although, as I mentioned, my book can really help you a lot here. Okay, so the sound is coming in. As I've said, the ossicles are like a heart-lung system that bring it into a rhythmicity. And then the stirrup, finally, conveys that sound as a movement. This is all, the sound has been transformed now into movement. It brings that movement to the cochlea. But the cochlea is, as I said, it's a little shell. How is it going to receive a delicate vibration? Because there is a little opening in it called the oval window, one of the most delicate, sensitive membranes in our entire organism. And its area is only 1/30th of that eardrum. So imagine the concentration that is going on here from the eardrum that already is sort of limiting the space in which that sound can be conveyed. Now we're bringing it down to 1/30th. I'll let you do the math to convert that into a percentage or a decimal if you'd like, or let the seventh graders do it. So it's just like what the lens and the retina of the eye do. They coalesce the light, they coalesce the image. Now we get that in sound as well. So, you know, if we think that, let's think you're a homeopathic, you're compounding homeopathic medicines, you don't take a very powerful herbal or mineral concentrate and use it straight. You potentize it. You keep rhythmically mixing it with water, diluting it, it seems, but actually, in a way, concentrating it from a point of view of soul and spirit. So the sound also is getting potentized in that respect. It's getting filtered through many surfaces and now coming to this oval window. And the cochlea itself is like a little potentization laboratory. It's also got a threefold structure. There's the vestibular canal, the tympanic canal, and the flexible cochlear duct. And this gets into the tiniest sort of microscopic realm here. But just again, let's go with the numbers. The tympanic canal takes up about half the volume of the cochlea. The volume that remains then, the vestibular canal, occupies about 2/3 of that, and the cochlear duct, the remaining third. So, mathematicians, the size of the cochlear duct to the vestibular canal, that proportion, is about half of that of the vestibular canal to the tympanic canal. And that, in turn, is about the same as the tympanic canal to the entire cochlear. In fact, what we have here in these proportions is essentially a golden proportion, which you will take up in a formal way probably next year in a class like Geometry in Nature or Sacred Geometry. But it's good to bring it to the children's attention now that in all ears, in everybody, there is the universality of this particular proportion, that sound must go through a series of stages, a series of steps. It must go through the temple where the door gets ever narrower, where straight is the gate, where it must get filtered and refined and potentized and refined again and filtered once more before it can finally touch those tiny drops of fluid within so that it is digested. This is another digestive process, which is why I say always begin your block not with the sensory system, but rather with the digestive system. That is the archetype of all of our interactions with the world on every level, though they be the quickest impressions of light, the most meditative, contemplative impressions of music. In the end, it all has to be digested. So that's where I'm going to leave you. You look at the numbers yourself and see these relationships, and you can find out a lot more about the ear. But I would say, always make it clear that it's not just a series of structures and sound goes through here and sound goes through there. Is it even sound anymore? What is it when it starts to go into the fluid world? No, very, very interesting. And we could think of the first days of creation and the voice of God, the Spirit of God moving on the waters and creating the firmament. All right, we'll talk next about the organ of the eye.